Page number 06 at 1397. Musaba Farhat, petitioner versus Robert M. Gates, Secretary of Defense et al. Mr. Willett for the petitioner, Ms. Jackson for the respondent.
Chief Judge Sentell, and may it please the court, if I might reserve four for rebuttal. I'd like to make two points this morning. One is why, at this late hour, there is no military authority to continue the detention of Huzaifa. And the second is why release is the right remedy in this case. We could begin with detention power. Now, everybody agrees he's not Al-Qaeda, he's not Taliban, and he's not on the battlefield. The government's theory is a two-step affiliation theory, and they have to show each step by a preponderance. Farhat, they say, is part of something called ETIM, East Turkestan Islamic Movement. And ETIM, they say, is an organization against which the president can use military force. We suggest that on this unusual record, they can meet neither of these two steps. And we bear in mind, as we analyze this, the purpose of military detention, which is to prevent return to the battlefield, and which is meant to be temporary and non-penal. So to the first step, is Farhat part of ETIM? The short answer is the CSRT could find no source document, not one, that he joined. Where do they go from that? We'll return in a moment to that, but perhaps proceed to the second question of whether ETIM is an organization.
You're skipping something. It's not just part of, it's part of or support, right?
Well, that's the regulatory definition, Your Honor. But there's no showing, if he hasn't joined ETIM, and I will suggest as well in the classified session that there's no.
Does the word part of mean you have to join something?
Well, all of this, Your Honor, is a gloss on the AUMF itself, which makes the enemy those who attacked us on 9/11 and those who harbored the attackers. ETIM is neither. The president was given discretion to determine who attacked us and who harbored the attack.
You're skipping over some important language from the AUFM. AUMF, I'm sorry. It's not just those who attacked, it's those who could have aided. And the president gets, when the president makes a determination that someone aided them.
Well, no, Your Honor, I believe I'm correct on the statute. What it says is those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the attacks, not aided the attackers. It then goes on to say anyone who harbored the attackers is also an enemy. But that's it.
What does it mean to aid the attack, and who gets to decide that?
Well, the president decides who aided the attacks. It might mean buying an air ticket for one of the murderers who was involved. It might mean training those 20 people. But the important thing here is the president never determined that ETIM had anything to do with these attacks. And in fact, the record makes that very clear. So we've got a guy who's held on an affiliation theory because of his affiliation with an organization he never joined. And an organization which isn't.
I wonder about that term, never joined. Now, without going into anything classified, you have him doing things at a location affiliated with the ETIM. They have to show a membership card or something?
Oh, no, Your Honor.
I wonder what you mean by never joined when you have the record you do of his.
I mean what the CSRT panel meant when they wrote those words, which have become unclassified. They said never actually joined. I believe we can show in context what they mean to do is distinguish that from the allegation that the people at this location were part of ETIM. And specifically, I would draw the court's attention to the undisputed fact that five other people at this place doing all of the same things were determined by our military not to be enemy combatants. So where does the government go? I mean, they go adroitly to all of the rhetorical tools in the bag, ellipsis and omission, and they pluck out of the record things that they regard as helpful. We can describe that better in the classified session, but they come up with all of these different theories that it's hard for me to respond to in the public session, other than to say this. The military itself read that whole record, every bit of it. They read all of the bits that the government omits in its brief to you. And the military said, This person is not someone who has joined this organization, and we can find no source evidence that this organization has ever even planned, thought about, contemplated becoming hostile to us. Now, they want to talk about lists. I think this court knows a lot about lists. You get a lot of list cases. Judge Sentell, you have decided more than a few of them. The important thing about lists is this. The only list this organization ever gets on is the list that is not, that includes entities that have not engaged in hostilities or direct threats to the United States. There is another list under 1189. It never makes that list. And it certainly never makes a list of organizations that aided the 9/11 attacks or harbored the attackers. The other thing about the list is, when Huzaifa was captured, at about the time he was captured, it wasn't on any lists. In fact, the State Department said, we don't regard the East Turkestan organization as a terrorist organization. Then, 10 months...
Did they ever, though?
They did. After they met with the Chinese in the August of 92, they put it on the watch list, Your Honor. And the watch list involves organizations in the United Kingdom.
You mean 2002.
Right? I'm sorry, 2002, Your Honor, is when it goes on the list. The point is, even the record in this case discloses that it goes on that list at the recommendation of China. Now, lots of people get on China's terrorism list. Just ask the Dalai Lama. The point is that it's not Beijing, and it's not even the president who decides who we are at war against. It's Congress, and Congress never authorized a war against this group. Now, the president could have gone to Congress and said, look, we need to expand the AUMF, but he didn't. So he's left with his arsenal of criminal justice tools, none of which has been deployed against our client for 6 years. So why are we here? It's not part of this. He doesn't join this group, and the group isn't the enemy. We're here as the CSRT candidly admitted, because there's a practical problem. There's nowhere to send him.
A little bit like in the last case. You have to at least be fair to what they said. And in the unclassified version, I appreciate there's much that we can't discuss in the open, but in the unclassified version, they said that they've classified him as an enemy combatant because he is affiliated with forces associated with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that are engaged in hostilities against the United States. So they have, and the forces they were talking about was ETIM. So you have to tell us why that first part of that argument, affiliated with, doesn't work.
I think you're
otherwise
right.
You wouldn't be fair to your client if you weren't going to at least argue that point.
There are two answers to your question. The first is, if you read on from where that, I may be quoting from page 11 or perhaps page 15.
I'm concluding from the bottom line, which is page, the conclusions of the tribunal.
Okay.
Page 13.
But the tribunal explains itself at
which
page...
Which says unclassified, I want to be sure.
Yes, and what I'm about to say is also unclassified. Yes. The tribunal explains itself at page 16 of the record, where it says, and I should quote directly...
Now you're on the classified part?
This language has been unclassified by the government.
Fair enough.
And it says the following. It picks up right on the phrase Your Honor mentioned. The tribunal found the detainee to be an enemy combatant because of his apparent ETIM affiliation. And then it goes on. But despite this fact that ETIM is said to be making plans for future terrorist activities against U.S. interests, no source document evidence was introduced to indicate whether or how this group has actually done so, that the detainee has actually joined ETIM, or that he himself has personally committed any hostile acts against the United States. This is the military panel explaining its findings. Now, the rest of my answer to your question necessarily will be in the classified session. But elsewhere in these findings, the panel explained, and I'm now quoting from language on page 15, also unclassified by the government, the detainee is therefore assessed as a potential threat. Potential threat. The practical problem had already been experienced because, again, an unclassified fact, in 2003, the colonel who commanded the CITF recommended his release. And if you think about the core issue that we're talking about here is that you detain the enemy to prevent his returning to the field to engage in combat with you. Now, who cares more about that than anyone? More than the lawyers, more than the policymakers, it is the soldiers who do not want to see the enemy returning to the battle to do harm to their brothers and sisters in arms. And we see in this record here, and two more places I can cite to you in the classified session, where soldiers are saying the remedy here is release.
Counsel, I don't know that that really cuts a whole lot of ice. Those particular soldiers were not delegated the authority to make any determination that was found, make a recommendation, or the one here could make a recommendation. But the chain of decision, I don't mean the chain of command, the chain of decision did not put them in a position to make a final determination. Somebody else did, the tribunal, and it decided differently. So,
well, Your Honor,
I'm not sure why we should afford any great weight to what one individual, military person.
Well, let's talk about the tribunal itself. The three military officers who became the most familiar with this record, what did they say should actually happen to this guy? Mm-hmm. They said he ought to be released. And we'll get to the detail on that statement in the classified session. It's in the record. So,
well, that's incomplete. They said he's an enemy combatant. Right?
Yes. They do, but they say
that's what then, we're really reviewing. Right.
But they're adopting a regulation which, as their own record explains, has been overbroadly applied to people who cannot legally be enemy combatants because they are not the enemy that Congress named and they didn't take the field. If I may spend a moment or two on remedy, we have asked for an order for his release, which would be an unusual thing in a DTA case, I submit. I rather think that the usual remedy would be that a detainee has shown you that there is exculpatory evidence that wasn't considered, and it ought to be considered together with the incriminating evidence. But here, in this case, you see the best record the government's ever going to have in this case, a record they've been to, spent a year, been through three proceedings here, and now they're in the Supreme Court to vindicate the fact that this is the record.
Can I ask about that? What in Bismuello, we said that this isn't the record, right? In Bismuello,
right. You said there's a broader record.
There's a broader record, and you asked that we hear the case in what is an unusual posture for us, which is before there is the complete record.
We did.
Okay. So the government says in their brief on this point, well, there is more evidence, and we put in evidence, but we have more, and the fact that the case had gone forward in the normal course, I suppose we would be seeing that now. So well, what does that do to your argument that this is sort of the only evidence or the best evidence or anything else? Maybe it's the least amount of evidence the government thought they could get away with.
Well, that's
why your answer that include any effect that may have on what the proper remedy is.
That's the context in which I'm asking.
Okay. The answer to your question, that's a hard position for the government to take because the government says this is what the record ought to be. The government never makes
that. Yeah, I got that, but
you're both internally inconsistent. You're entitled to be. You're litigators, but get the government.
All right. But at least, just to be clear, at least until the Supreme Court decides otherwise, this is not what the record is supposed to be, right?
Well,
as far as this court is concerned.
Right.
The record is broader. That's our precedent, and we are bound to it. I assume that at some point in the relatively near future, we will know whether the Supreme Court takes Bismuello. If they don't take it, then our opinion will be the final on that question.
Yes, Your Honor. 2 points. First, the government has never represented to you that it has any additional evidence or theory as to Parhat that would make him an enemy combatant.
I thought...
They say that they may have. And they've had our motion for, I think, since November. They've never represented to you that there's some other thing they want to add to the record. That's the first point. The second point is that this record never gets better for the government. It only gets worse because it sucks in exculpatory evidence if the law of the case stands. We're here because he's sitting in Camp 6, and we can't wait for this appellate badman to go on till the crack of doom. When we saw what they said the record was, finally, after years of asking for it, we said we win on their record. That's why we're here. Your Honors, I recognize that in many cases, remand will be the appropriate remedy. But here, no remand is going to discover a force authorization from Congress that authorizes military force against ETIM. The president never determined that ETIM attacked us on 9/11. It didn't. The president never determined that ETIM harbored attackers. It didn't. So nothing's going to change in a remand. And the government hasn't suggested how anything could change in a remand. Now, I want to be practical. I'm sure it's uncomfortable to contemplate a direct order for release, but this is a person who's never been even accused of committing a crime or engaging in any wrongdoing. Unlike Martinez, in Clark against Martinez, who was an alien with no right to be present, who had committed and been convicted of crimes, the Supreme Court held that he had to be released into the lower 48. And we're asking no more in this case.
Do we really have jurisdiction to say released into the United States? This is a person who, so far as the record reflects, has never entered the country.
He's like Martinez, Your Honor. You do have jurisdiction.
Martinez never entered the country?
Well, he was physically present, but he had not made an
now,
entry.
Your client not only does not have a legal entry, such as Martinez did not have, your client didn't have any entry at all.
Well, he is at
under
a place.
No definition of the word entry has he ever been in the United States, unless you count Guantanamo, which is another thing the Supreme Court hasn't really gotten. Right.
I understand Your Honor's point, but the fact of the matter is that in law he stands no differently than did Martinez, because Martinez also had not made an entry in law. He was part of the Mariel boatlift.
He was held to be improperly detained within the United States.
But there
are
no...
They didn't say you release him into the general population. They said release him. And where he was within the United States. When you released him, he was here.
Let me come at
your answer. Are you telling us we should release Farhat into Guantanamo?
No.
Loose on the beach in Cuba?
No, Your Honor. I'm telling you that I'm telling you that in the third branch of our government, we're all about remedies that have meaning. Our government has tried for years to send him to all of our allies, evidently not worried that he would pose any danger there.
That seems to be the real practical problem here.
And there is no other remedy.
Doesn't mean we have authority to do it. There is no other remedy does not imply that we have authority to give you the remedy you're asking for.
I disagree, Your Honor.
You're wrong. You get to disagree, but you don't get to decide. I don't know of any case that says that because there is not some other remedy satisfactory to the parties that empowers the court to do whatever it is the plaintiff wants.
Well, I'm not taking that position, Your Honor.
What
I am saying is that if you find there is a legal wrong in a matter of imperative concern, which is imprisonment, it is the very essence of courts to give a meaningful remedy. And that's what...
That doesn't empower us to override the immigration laws.
Oh, no. His
release... Martinez, you had a direct issue there of somebody who had physically entered the country and as to whether or not what his legal status was at that point. You don't have that here.
No, I don't.
We would actually be ordering the United States to allow this person physical entry into the United States if we did what your most broad claim is.
I'm not asking for asylum. He would still be deportable. I'm saying you can order...
They could bring him in, but they could kick him out the next day?
If they can find a safe place to send him. Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. The point is, you can order that he be released, that he not be sent to China, and that he not be sent to any of China's satellites, and the government can figure it out from there. If they can make an arrangement with France or Germany, fine. If they can't, they have to bring him here. Otherwise...
So you don't have an objection to transfer as long as it's not to China or something?
Not at all, Your Honor. I have just a moment to reserve. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, counsel. We'll round you up to 2 minutes on rebuttal. Here for the government.
May it please the court, let me begin with the question whether the record supports the tribunal's determination that Mr. Farhat affiliated himself with ETIM. The evidence...
I take it that the regulation does not use that word.
No, it does not.
Isn't that a problem?
No, I think the regulation says...
part of or supporting.
Part of or support. I think affiliated is a shorthand for one or the other.
It has no other.
You want to move to one or the other?
The evidence supporting the tribunal's determination that Mr. Parhaut is affiliated with ETIM is largely in unclassified material that I can discuss here. Mr. Parhaut, in his own testimony, said that Hassan Maksum visited the camp at which he joined and identified Mr. Maksum as his, i.e. Parhaut's, Uyghur leader. The significance of that we can talk about later. Mr. Parhaut went voluntarily, traveled from his country to Afghanistan to attend a military training camp. By his own admission, he went there in order to prepare for what he hoped would be belligerency against China. He lived there for 4 months. He trained with an AK-47 assault rifle. And
you don't need to review the entire factual record. We have read it, and you may want to get closer to the legal issue.
Okay.
You could take a long time on what you're doing now.
That's fair. The point is that someone living at and training in that way in a military camp, Judge Sintel, would be subject to military detention under background law of war principles, which support the detention of members of armed forces and also civilians who follow the army around. Article 4 of the Geneva Convention speaks of supply contractors and war correspondents, individuals of that nature. Mr. Parhaut is living at the camp for months. At a minimum, if a supply contractor or a war correspondent can be detained, then so can someone who is there receiving weapons training and doing the various things that Mr. Parhaut was doing.
Does it matter? Don't you also have to show that the camp is ETIM camp and that it's ETIM is associated with Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and that ETIM was engaged in hostilities against the United States or the coalition?
Yes, we have to show each of those, Judge Garland, with respect to the question, the connection of the camp to ETIM. I can give you the whole story in a classified setting, but one critical fact in the public testimony is that Mr. Parhaut identifies the camp leader and the leader of his Uyghur group as Maksum. We do also have to show that ETIM is associated with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. The discussion of that has to occur primarily in a classified setting. And we do, under the regulation, also have to show that ETIM forces are engaged in hostilities against U.S. or coalition forces.
Where does the associated with language originate? It's not in the AUMF.
No, it's not, Judge Sintel. It's in the enemy combatant definition, and it's an
enemy combatant definition contained within
the combatant status review tribunal regulations.
So it is regulations,
yes,
and not statute.
Correct.
Does the statute support that definition?
I think it does, because
is the statutory authority the DTA or the AUMF?
The statutory authority is the AUMF. The AUMF.
Where in the AUMF would we find the support for that language in the regulation?
The AUMF speaks of nations, organizations, or persons determined by the president to have committed the attacks or harbored those who do.
On September 11th.
Correct. That definition is unproblematic in its application, at least to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Al-Qaeda is...
We get that.
Okay. Then Al-Qaeda, for its own tactical advantages and in violation of the laws of war, blurs its own outer bounds.
You have to show that the ETIM and slash or the individual Parhat aided, abetted, assisted on or before September 11th?
No.
Within the terms of that statute?
No, we have to show one of two things. To get within the AUMF, we have to show that ETIM is part of the Al-Qaeda organization in fact. And to come back to your question about...
Dependent, not upon the associated with language in a vacuum, as it were, but on the proposition of equivalency. That is to say that ETIM is equivalent to Taliban or Al-Qaeda?
It is, within the meaning of the statute, is part of the same organization.
Those words are not in the statute, part of the same organization, but you're saying that that's implicit. That
we're saying one of two things. Either the word organization, read in context, can permissibly be understood to encompass not only Al-Qaeda defined in some rigid, formalistic way as, I don't know what it would be precisely because they don't issue membership cards or serial numbers, but people in a direct chain of command to bin Laden. Is organization better understood in that sense, or alternatively, can it permissibly be understood as an organization in fact? People who effectively are working together towards a common purpose. And we suggest that given...
And how did they aid the 9/11 attacks?
It's not that they aided the 9/11 attacks, Judge Corbett.
Planned, authorized, committed, or aided.
That's right. Al-Qaeda...
The terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th.
Those attacks.
Al-Qaeda committed those attacks, and this case is about determining the outer bounds of that organization in the context of...
Are dependent on the proposition that ETIM is properly defined as being part of Al-Qaeda, not that it aided or abetted or aided or harbored Al-Qaeda, but that it's part of it.
Correct. In order to fit them in the AUMF, I think...
Well, you have to fit them in the AUMF unless we go to presidential inherent authority.
I don't think so, because we do have presidential... we do have presidential authority, a rather modest claim on the facts of this case for the following reason. Let's assume, as I hope you don't, that you define organization to mean Al-Qaeda in some rigid formalistic sense. Congress at least has authorized hostilities against that entity, Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Then you would have a question whether the president, in the context of prosecuting those hostilities, has Article II commander-in-chief authority to apply military force not only to, in the hypothetical, the named entity Al-Qaeda, but also to associated forces who, in fact, are fighting with Al-Qaeda, engaged in hostilities.
Has Little V. Barimi ever been overruled?
No, it hasn't, but take World War II precedents. Congress authorizes a military conflict with Germany. That
was a perfect war. World War II was a perfect war.
It was a perfect war. The point is...
We're not in a perfect war today, and we weren't in Little V. Barimi.
The point, Judge Sintel, is when Congress named the enemy Germany, and it turns out that Vichy France is fighting alongside Germany, mm-hmm. The president used military force against Vichy France without legal controversy.
But that was not a limited war. We're dealing in Little V. Barimi with a congressional authorization that allowed the... I may get it backward, but to and from was the distinction on the ships.
Right. It's a fair point.
France,
but
or from France, and could you seize a Danish vessel? It was going the other way. And the Supreme Court held no. Where Congress has authorized a limited war, the president cannot use his inherent authority to go beyond the terms of the authorization.
In the quasi-war cases, Congress was very precise in authorizing the exact meets and bounds for purposes of capture and salvage rights and so on. In that context, you're right. The court drew a negative inference and construed that to bind the president's power. I don't think the AUMF is sensibly construed as authorizing only a quasi-response to September 11. The difference between the AUMF and the Little versus Barimi statutes, the AUMF is written in very broad terms. It expressly, it describes the enemy, it doesn't name the enemy. It gives the president the power to work out the details of who the enemy is. It is written expressly in terms of authorization. So we think the better analogy...
You think that any entity that was associated with al-Qaeda before the 9/11 attacks, in any way, let's say a hypothetical, an entity that had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, but they were associated with al-Qaeda in some way, had a military camp on the North Pole or something, does the AUMF authorize use of force against them? By the mere fact that they're associated with al-Qaeda?
That's a hard case. Maybe not.
Because
maybe not, Judge Griffith.
That's a hard case because the AUMF says it has to be linked to the 9/11 attacks.
The AUMF grants authorization with respect to the organization that committed the September 11 attacks. It does not speak to the question of how to define the outer bounds of a terrorist organization.
Isn't the 9/11 attacks the touchstone of the AUMF? Yeah. Planned, authorized, committed, or aided the 9/11 attacks. Not planned, authorized, committed, or aided this nefarious organization in pursuing its goals. It's the focus on the 9/11 attacks.
Absolutely. Al-Qaeda committed the 9/11 attacks. And the question is what constitutes Al-Qaeda. But Judge Griffith, I don't want to fight this for too much because the critical point is the regulations narrow the government's authority in exactly the way your question suggests by requiring not only association with Al-Qaeda, but also that the associated entity in fact is committing hostilities against the U.S.
That's your difficulty. That's not narrower. That's
broader.
It's not narrow. It's different. It's broader. The statute speaks in terms of aiding the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
You are telling us that aiding terrorist activity is narrower than that. It's not.
In response
to... The 9/11 attacks occurred on 9/11.
Right.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda committed those attacks. In response to Judge Griffith's question about whether any entity affiliated with Al-Qaeda in any way could be considered Al-Qaeda for AUMF purposes, my response to that is the regulations are narrower than his hypothetical because they require not only affiliation with Al-Qaeda but also engagement in hostilities. Judge Sintel, if I could come back...
I don't see how that is narrower than the 9/11 attack. Hostilities could include other things, and I think in... application has included things beyond the 9/11 attacks, has it not?
I'm sorry.
All right. Look, you're saying hostilities is narrower than 9/11 attacks?
No, I'm addressing the question of what kind of affiliation with Al-Qaeda will bring an affiliated entity within
the
meaning organization.
And in addressing it, you seem to be saying that the regulations are narrower than the statute. And I'm not sure that I understand why you're saying that when the regulations speak in terms of hostilities and the statute speaks in terms of the 9/11 attacks. Hostilities.
Regulation.
Are you saying that
Judge Sintel, the regulations require affiliation with either Al-Qaeda, which committed the attacks, or the Taliban, which harbored Al-Qaeda, but they also require engagement in hostilities against...
You're saying the nature
States.
Of the affiliation has to be engagement in hostility.
Right. And I think that language in the regulation, Judge Griffith, takes care of your hypothetical. Judge Sintel, if I could come back to the little question of negative implication, given the breadth of the AUMF and the invitation to the president to apply it, we think the better analogy is not the negative implication that flows from the narrowly drawn statutes in Little, but rather Justice Jackson's statement in Youngstown that the courts should strive as much as possible to uphold assertions of presidential power with respect to the outside world, that silence in the area of war making does not necessarily constitute disapproval.
Tripartite Youngstown analysis, which I think probably has been, although originally in a concurrence, probably become law of the court in
right.
James and Moore, which I don't think anybody cites, but that has three levels. Where Congress and the President are both acting in the same direction, where the President's authority is at the zenith, where Congress has acted in the opposite direction, at which point has acted and the President is doing something inconsistent therewith, where the presidential authority is at its nadir, and where Congress is silent. So you are in a situation here that's either the most or the least. It's not in the middle. Congress is not silent. It's
I
said something. So either you've got to act consistent with it, or you've got to show us that it was within the President's inherent authority if he's inconsistent. That's where he's at his nature.
I don't think so, because Justice Jackson speaks of Congress sometimes in Category 2 inviting an independent presidential response. And think of Dames and Moore. Dames and Moore is perhaps the best illustration of this principle. Supreme Court in Dames and Moore specifically found that neither the IEPA statute nor the Hostage Act authorized what the president undertook to do, which is espouse and settle certain claims against Iran. The court
back, you did cite Dames and Moore in the brief. Excuse me, go ahead.
And the court in that context did not apply a Little versus Barim negative implication, Judge Sintel. It said that legislation which by its terms does not apply can invite, that's the court's word, mm-hmm. invite other measures. In that case, the president's settling of claims incidental to the IEPA undertaking. In this case, Congress authorizes a war against Al-Qaeda. Military forces encounter associated entities that look a lot like co-belligerents under traditional laws of war. Our point is simply that
pause over that. The co-belligerent definition requires considerably more involvement than what you're talking about here, doesn't it?
Co-belligerent definition is
you have to take an active part.
Different forces fighting together, and if we have association and engagement in hostilities by the associated forces, I think it's a fair analogy to co-belligerency. So our position,
the question about whether he's under co-belligerent rules,
mm-hmm.
you have two recognized armies, two recognized states.
Mm-hmm.
He's not, Farhad himself doesn't fit in easily within the co-belligerent rule. Maybe for the last part of the argument, but not for the first part of the argument.
Farhad easily, I think, qualifies as either a member of ETIM forces or someone who follows those forces around in the field in the sense of...
Well, there seems to be a split in opinion with respect to the law of war as to whether a mere camp follower is sufficient.
I don't think so. The Third Geneva Convention is clear on that point. It follows the Hague Convention, which follows the Lieber Code, all of which...
The Third Geneva Convention uses the word camp followers.
It uses, get you the exact, persons, Article 4 of the Third Geneva Convention, 4A, subclause 4, persons who accompany the armed forces without being members, and it enumerates various categories, civilian members of aircraft crew, war correspondents, supply contractors, labor.
Those people are being treated as prisoners of war.
Treated as prisoners of war.
They're not treating these.
Treated as prisoners of war if they satisfy the requirements of following the laws of war and wearing uniforms. But we know from Kieran that belligerence.
Under the uniform, you're not protected by the laws of war.
You're not entitled to POW protections, but you are subject to detention authority. So a supply contractor not following the laws of war is subject to the detention authority, though he would lose his entitlement to POW status. So connecting, that's our theory for
connecting.
I'm not sure how this I mean, this is a specific section which includes having to receive authorization from the armed forces they accompany and who have an identity card. It doesn't tell us what to do in the other situation that we have here.
It seems to me a fair analogy that if someone attached to the military in the way that a civilian member of aircraft crew is, can be permissibly detained ancillary to the detention of the actual forces, then so can Mr. Parhat, who's in the camp for months at a time, receiving weapons training and doing one other military act reflected at page A52 of the classified appendix.
Let me ask,
you said that under the AUMF, ETIM comes in because it's part of the same organization. That's your theory, right?
Right.
And that is because it's working together toward a common purpose. That was your language, right?
Working together for a common purpose and engaged in belligerent acts.
Well,
on
the first point, I take it there's no unclassified evidence that you can point to on that point, right?
That's right. The most I could say with respect to unclassified evidence is there is circumstantial evidence that a military camp in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan at Tora Bora circa 2001 is likely to be affiliated with either the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, but the details of that we can't get into.
Right. So just to be clear, so your position is that any Uyghur to whom Afghanistan gave sanctuary against the Chinese, whether it's an ETIM camp or it's some other organization as to which there is no evidence of connection to Al-Qaeda, and as which, as at least they argue in this case, that their only enemy is China, that would be enough if they were in such a camp in Afghanistan at that time to detain them as enemies?
Not any Uyghur. Any Uyghur
Any Uyghur camp. Any camp of Uyghurs training to fight the Chinese, if that's their argument, if that were the case.
I think we need an ETIM camp.
We need an ETIM camp.
Because ETIM is the entity associated with Al-Qaeda. And we need for the individual.
And you need evidence that ETIM is in fact part of the Al-Qaeda organization.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And you don't have any unclassified evidence of that. And the circumstantial fact that they're located in that area
is not enough.
It's not enough.
You concede that's not enough.
Right. No, it's not enough.
And just so I'm clear, and we'll talk about this more in the classified session, the only classified evidence does not state the source. Is that correct?
Correct.
Might I ask we not go any further into classified until we get
that's fair.
The courtroom video.
But that raises a question I have, though, that I think we can talk about here. Your position as to the reliability of the evidence that that the CRT sees. What should we be looking for as we review whether the CSRT followed the procedures that the Secretary set forth, including preponderance of the evidence? As we look at that, how are we supposed to determine whether the evidence that was presented is reliable?
Yeah, and in addressing that, remember that although the procedure prescribes that the tribunal could accept hearsay, it said if the circumstances indicate reliability, I'm verifying.
Yeah. I think
remember, we have to have that reliability underlying.
With respect to the particular documents, I think I'd rather discuss them in classified setting. I think in this proceeding where we are talking about factual determinations about associations and where under the terms of this court's order, this court's review is on the record made to the agency, I think the review would be deferential to the Combatant Status Review Tribunal that was entrusted to find the facts.
Well, then, what's the standard by which the tribunal is to determine?
The tribunal makes a preponderance of the evidence determination.
I'm talking about the reliability.
Well, they have
something in front of them. How do they determine whether it's reliable or not?
They're told by your rules they have to determine
to be reliable.
The regulations don't spell that out, I think.
Right. So what do they do? Since they don't spell it out, what were they doing here, insofar as you can say it in an unclassified search?
They do what any finder of fact does. They look at the evidence and make the best judgments that they can. I think the judgments in this particular case are amply supported.
You agree that they have to be able to assess the reliability of the evidence?
Yeah, that's part of their fact-finding function, yes. Right.
Now, when we're talking about review in this circuit, I'm a little confused about the government's position. Is the government's position that we are supposed to review to determine whether a preponderance of the evidence supports the CSRT's conclusion, or just some evidence, or some other deferential standard that you're going to ask?
A deferential standard.
Well, then how does that square with what the Solicitor General told the Supreme Court not very long ago, December 5th, in Boumediene? And the question Justice Stevens asked General Clement was, what the standard was, General Clement said, that question, of course, can be considered by the D.C. Circuit on review because they are specifically entitled to a preponderance review in the D.C. Circuit. And Justice Stevens then said, but with respect to those claims, do you make the argument in your brief that some evidence is enough to refute that claim, or do you say that it is a preponderance standard? I'm sure you know this because I expect you were sitting there. Maybe not, but you certainly have read this. General Clement, it's a preponderance standard. That's what's set forth in the statute. Now, I take it the government is going to take the same position before this court that they took before the Supreme Court, right?
Yes, but the preponderance standard in the statute applies to the tribunal determination.
I realize it could be read that way, but that is not what the Solicitor General of the United States said to the Supreme Court of the United States. He said they're entitled to a preponderance review in the D.C. Circuit. And this was in specific response to a question about the sum evidence argument, which is the argument you're making to us. Did he misspeak? Are you authorized to say he misspoke?
No, I'm not. I think that when a statute requires an administrative tribunal to find facts by a preponderance and authorizes review in this court of that factual determination, I think the more natural assumption would be that review is deferential to the fact finder. Now, I realize...
Are you saying he misspoke? The question couldn't have been clearer to him. Are you saying... I mean, this was presented, and it was presented in this way because it was a very important issue to the court as to whether the DTA was going to be sufficient as compared to habeas, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now, do you want to change the government's position either by filing a letter with the Supreme Court or by filing a letter with us? I mean, your brief did not actually take the sum evidence.
No, we didn't.
In this case, you agreed that our previous opinion in Bismula seemed to suggest
Bismula,
we were in review.
Bismula does seem to foreclose that view with respect to hearings in which this court reviews or decides fact questions on the expanded Bismula record. I have no doubt that's true.
And why would there be any difference with respect to the narrower record?
I think the difference is that in this case, under this court's order, this court is reviewing for purposes of this proceeding on a closed record made in the agency, which is ordinarily done deferentially.
So this is only a psychoanalysis of what this court decided.
It's an assessment of the most natural legal consequences of an order limiting review to an administrative record, which I concede is not how Bismula cases
not how Bismula was decided.
Will proceed.
Are we through with that line? I would take you. I know time has long since expired, but we don't follow the niceties of the Supreme Court always. On the question of remedy, I know you don't want to assume that we rule with the petitioners on merits, but assuming we do, now their position is that, broadly taken, we release the petitioner. Narrower taken, that we release him into the United States. But forget about the where we release him for a moment. What do you say the relief would be if we do find that the record does not support detention?
I think the relief would be remand for the Defense Department to assess whether or not it wants to attempt another tribunal determination. In any event, I don't think release is appropriate for reasons spelled out by Judge Robertson in the Kasim opinion. It's difficult to imagine how this court could order release into the United States.
Okay, forget the end of the United States.
Okay, then.
At this point, but I don't have the precise quotation. Perhaps I'm not as well prepared as my colleague, but I thought the United States position in Boumediene was that the Detainee Treatment Act is the equivalent of habeas, that therefore the question does not have to be reached as to whether there is a habeas right or doesn't have to be determined. Now, if it's the equivalent of habeas, the habeas remedy here would be release.
In fact, to follow up on the preparation issue, Solicitor General Clement did say that if it was necessary to satisfy the suspension clause, that release would be available to the court, right? That's what you say, even in your own brief. We're not at that stage yet because we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to say.
Right.
But under those circumstances, the Solicitor General is saying that release would be an alternative.
What he said was that the Detainee Treatment Act doesn't preclude release. Mm-hmm. But let's come to the very practical question of what relief. Put aside the Detainee Treatment Act. Let's assume we're here on habeas, Judge Garland. If we were here on habeas, you were to rule against us, you would be in exactly the same position as Judge Robertson, who ruled against us on a district court habeas.
Well, you solved that problem, though, didn't you? You solved that problem before the Court of Appeals had to consider the issue, right?
Right, but
because by transferring him to another country.
But the point
is, if you did that, you would solve our problem as well.
Yeah,
as well as Mr. Parrott's
problem.
The point is, Judge Garland.
The question for us today is not based on his having been released. It's based on the possibility of his having made a record upon which, or you having failed to make a record, your side having failed to make a record upon which he can be detained. If this is the equivalent of habeas for constitutional purposes, then isn't the only remedy possible here release?
Or transfer. When the judge...
Get him out of the place he's trying to get habeas out of.
One permissible habeas remedy is release or retry within some reasonable time. Sure. That would be equivalent to the remand I'm suggesting.
What if he were retried and either the tribunal thought that he was not an enemy combatant in light of whatever we said about it, or it was appealed again and we again said it wasn't enough, then what if we were at that stage?
On a second appeal?
Yes.
I think the case for ordering release at that point would be substantially stronger. But on a first review, I think whether you conceive of this as an administrative proceeding where the presumptive relief is remand or as a habeas...
Judge Randolph would not agree with you that the presumptive relief in an administrative case is remand, right?
I'm not sure.
Well, he's written several times that vacatur is the correct...
It's not necessarily parallel to those cases,
right,
in which I've concurred with Judge Randolph.
I've disagreed with him, so it's not a problem. But when you say presumptive...
It's a problem with me.
If you contemplate release, Judge Sintel, you suggested a lack of comfort of the option of release into the United States. Think about the other options. The only other possible options are release into a secure military base or ordering transfer to a country that won't take him, or the only country that would take him where there are legitimate concerns of mistreatment.
In That still gets you to the question that Judge Garland's asking. If this were the rehearing after remand, I think you have a very valid argument that the norm in habeas cases, when we grant habeas, is we say release him or retry him within X period of time.
I think if you came to the point on a subsequent proceeding where it looked like we were approaching the endless circle of remands and that was inappropriate, I think probably the best you could do, given the lack of any better options, is order the Defense Department to treat the detainee as a non-enemy combatant. In sum, Congress authorized the president at least to commit hostilities and detain members of Al-Qaeda. Whether you consider
a non-enemy combatant or an enemy non-combatant.
You mean as not an enemy combatant?
I don't understand the terminology non-enemy combatant. Do you mean just not as an enemy combatant?
Treat him not as an enemy combatant.
At that point, then, they have no authority to detain him, do they?
They have no authority under the laws of war to detain him. They have a practical problem of finding him a place to go. He would be in a different legal category in an improved position, but
he'd be out of solitary confinement.
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we have long since exhausted your. Amongst us, we've long since exhausted your time.
And me as well. Thank you.
And you as well. And. You have 2 minutes left, and I do not warranty that we will stop at the end of 2 minutes. We don't seem to have on anything else. Excuse me. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the proposition that Al-Qaeda equals ETIM, that you can conflate the two, I needn't waste any time. We can demolish that proposition in the classified session. It will not stand scrutiny of the record.
Okay, hold that for classified, then.
Your Honor, little, you're right about little. Never been overruled. And every time Congress acts, Youngstown, Hamdan, Congress wins. It's only in the zone where some fort is shelled while Congress is out of session that this power arises. The interesting question about Youngstown is, who wins? President Truman is saying there's a national catastrophe, and yet he's not allowed to steal to seize the steel mills.
I don't think he tried to steal the steel mills.
Some would say he did.
Your Honor, my grandmother would have been among those, Your Honor.
Mine would not.
You don't want to know what my father said about Harry Truman.
Mr. Failed Haberdasher, I once heard. Your Honor, Mr. Katz's position inevitably takes the government to the very force authorization that Congress denied on September 14th. They wanted the authority to wage a preemptive war globally against those who threaten us, and Congress said no. It is 9/11. It's not 9/10. It's not 9/12. And that's set out in detail in the brief. There's no dispute about it. On this notion that aiding the attacker is close enough to aiding the attacks in the statute, the government never explains where you go with the next clause, which says harbored the attackers. Harbored is a much narrower kind of aid. It would mean nothing if aiding the attacks could be
read. Well, we have lots of make surety sure cases, though, that the fact that you have another word which might be encompassed within the first word does not inherently narrow the first word. It could be the Congress is simply making certain that they've got that covered.
Well, where would you go in this reading, Your Honor? Because what they're trying to single out is attackers.
We would go to that quote from Shakespeare that Judge Williams likes so well. They're trying to make surety sure. They're just trying to be sure that they have that.
Well, we prefer that the quality of mercy is not strained after 6 years, Your Honor.
That's very good, boy, the two of you. That's.
How many minutes do we have?
I did not prepare Shakespeare before this argument. I obviously should have.
Now, it is the standard is preponderance. The rules say preponderance.
Yeah, before you, could you just skip to the remedy question just for the moment? You can come back to preponderance. Chief Judge Sentell raised an interesting analogy, which is to habeas, which is in the ordinary habeas case, if we found the evidence insufficient, the person would be sent back for a retrial. Why is that not an? I hadn't thought about that. Why is that? Oops.
I have just...
All right. Why? I give you dispensation. Why isn't that the appropriate analogy here? And not even an analogy. Obviously, you think habeas is a better remedy than DTA.
Because, Your Honor, when you get a remand in a habeas case, what's happening is the same thing that's happening in a remand in an ad law case. A rule has been established that has to be applied. You know, the prisoner didn't get a lawyer, or he wasn't able to confront the evidence, or a document should have been admitted. So it has to be it's not that there isn't incriminating evidence. There's now a broader package of evidence, so the right remedy is remand. Here, nothing can make Etim the enemy. Nothing. We'll address this notion that Etim is somehow on a battlefield. It gets us into the classified zone. But Etim as an entity never fits any of the categories because Congress never defined a category that you can put Etim into. And this is where the government really gets into it.
Just a minute, counsel. Abstractly, if the government could show that Etim was working side by side, hand in glove, all of those other cliches with Al-Qaeda prior to September 11, why wouldn't it be a proper holding that they are the equivalent of Al-Qaeda for terms of the AUMN?
Well, I can't answer in the public session, but I can in the classified.
Oh, he's asking you hypothetically.
You can make an assumption. Hypothetically. You don't need anything classified to answer that question.
Your Honor, it's your transitive principle in the Iranian case. If it's the same entity with a different name, it's the same.
If A equals B, B equals C, then C equals A.
Right. But there's no fact in this record to suggest that. And here,
you would concede that the principle would apply if the facts were such that we could hold that the tribunal could properly recognize that an entity were working hand in hand and hand in glove and side by side and heim and heim with the Al-Qaeda, then we could hold that it's included within the AUMF.
If it were the same entity, yes, Your Honor.
That, but, you know, that would make it the same entity versus AUMF, would it not?
Yes, it would. But, Your Honor, I come... Usually,
I understand that you say that's not this case. But
it's not this case, and it's not even represented to you in year six of this imprisonment that there's any basis to believe that. If I may... just come back to this preponderance point. The way that the architecture works is this. The regulations say preponderance of the evidence. The question to be asked is whether they followed the regulations. So you're entitled to look at the evidence and see whether a preponderance supports the conclusion. Now, Your Honor asked the question about reliability. The interesting thing is this CSRT panel, composed of three military officers, did make a determination of reliability. It's a powerful one. It's at page 16. Quoted in the briefs, it is not classified any longer, and it says as follows. Despite the fact that the ETIM is said to be making plans for future terrorist activities against U.S. interests, no source document evidence was introduced to indicate whether or how this group has actually done so.
That unfortunately, that doesn't get you home.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That doesn't get you home because that's an assessment of future attacks on the United States. That's not a discussion at all about what their relationship may have been before.
And right? I can get home on the past in the classified
section. Oh, fine. But you agree that that one assessment that you're talking about doesn't really solve the problem.
I don't quite agree. I think in the context of the statement, what's really being said is, look, we get this information that's unsourced and that suggests ETIM is our enemy. We can't find any source document that they're even planning to be our enemy. That's what they're saying there. Your Honor, I have deep...
My colleagues have further questions. Your time is once again exhausted. I'm going to arbitrarily and capriciously give you a minute to wind up if you need it, and then we will close the courtroom, empty the courtroom except for necessary for those personnel who have a need to know and have security clearances. I'll go ahead with you 1 minute, and then we'll clear the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I had 1 minute left before you, I would devote it to a great judge from my hometown.
That is what you have, 1 minute. This better be a good judge.
It's about us.
who sentenced the shoe bomber some years ago and famously admonished him that we Americans are all about freedom. And I think at the end of the day, this case isn't really about military law at all, given what's in the record. This case is about whether Judge Young got that right and whether we institutionally are serious about that value. The guy's in year six. They've been trying for years to send him to all of our allies. Nobody wants to brook China. There's no other remedy. That's why we're here. Thank you.
Okay, the argument in the unclassified phase has now ended. As I said, we will take a brief recess, however long is necessary, to clear the courtroom of all but those personnel who have clearances and they need to know. I understand a sweep will be conducted, so everybody please cooperate. Those who are entitled to be here, I think, know it. And if you don't know it, you're not entitled to be here. Give us recess.
Thank you.